Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning with the most explicit warning yet from Israel that it's preparing for a ground invasion into Lebanon. It came today from Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, the head of the IDF, the Israel Defence Forces. He was visiting troops in northern Israel, close to the border.
You hear the planes up there. We are attacking all day. This is both to prepare the ground for your potential entry and to continue hitting Hezbollah. Today, Hezbollah has expanded its arc of fire, and later in the day, it will receive a very strong response. You will prepare.
The chief of the IDF went on to say, your entry into those areas, your encounter with Hezbollah operatives will show them what it means to face a much stronger and more experienced force than you are. You will go in, he continued. Well, in the meantime, large-scale Israeli airstrikes have continued across Lebanon, killing dozens. The Iran-backed Hezbollah militia has returned some fire, including early this morning local time, launching for the very first time a ballistic missile towards Israel's biggest city, Tel Aviv. That missile was intercepted by Israeli air defence. We'll hear from a spokesman for the IDF in a moment, but let's head the other side of the border now to Lebanon and Fadi Zghreib. He's 24 years old. He lives in the town of Amshit, about an hour north of Beirut. And minutes before we spoke, he told me he'd seen Israeli airstrikes hit mountains near him.
In our areas, it's predominantly Christian populated, and according to President Netanyahu, he had promised that he had nothing to do with Lebanon, he was just targeting Hezbollah. Now in these areas, there are very small patches that do have certain Hezbollah population, and these are the areas that were hit.
You're saying that you live in a Christian area, and these were Hezbollah areas that were hit. Do you think, well, I should be safe where I am?
At this point, when you're being targeted by hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of rockets, you have no other way of thinking other than just to be hopeful that President Netanyahu was actually genuine by stating that he did not want anything to do with Lebanon. Like, there's nothing you can do. Most of the times, we cannot even hear the rockets before they hit. It's that instantaneous.
I mean, if you had the chance to move somewhere where you thought perhaps it would be safer, is that an option that you could take, that you would take?
This is a discussion that we've been having all across these 2 weeks. For us, just based on where I live, moving isn't exactly much safer. Because we, like I said, this is the area that supposedly should not be getting hit. If I were to move more north, that's worse. More south, horrible. Towards the mountains, there's always Hezbollah spots that are now being targeted. So sitting tight right now is our best option.
Given how divided Lebanon has been for so long, you say you live in a Christian area. Some Christians support Hezbollah, others oppose Hezbollah. I mean, what do you feel about this fight between Hezbollah and Israel?
I guarantee you that if you were to ask any Lebanese this question, you would have a different answer every time. It's based on culture, based on religion, based on political beliefs. But primarily, we all agree on the fact that Hezbollah has always been dedicated to defend this Palestinian cause. And we all in unison agree that this is a humanitarian cause that should be dealt with. But are we, as a small country that has long been hit by local regional conflicts, prepared to give more than we have already given to absolutely make no difference? That's where people are going to be divided. This is where me, as a Christian youth, and that doesn't matter even if I'm Christian or not, this is just a humanitarian belief, I stand with them. When I say them, I mean Palestine. But it's extremely clear that us going into a full-blown war and being decimated by Israeli missiles isn't helping anyone. So why are we in this conflict anyways? So if you want what I'm feeling, this is what I'm feeling. Now, the anger, the frustration you feel when you realize that you're going into a war that you did not want will never lead to you thinking, all right, good, let them be hit. Never. At the end of the day, they are people from your country. They are people with different beliefs, different cultures, different religions, but they are from your country. So it's extremely unfortunate what's going on, but I will tell you point blank, we just want this to be over. We just want this to be over. We deserve to live a few days of peace. This cannot go for much longer. Like we have nothing anymore. Our futures are decimated. We already had no chance of higher education or higher job opportunities. What now? Like, what is there left we can give?
Fadi Shraib, speaking to you from the Lebanese town of Amshit. Well, given the statements from the IDF chief of staff today, is it about when, not if, for an Israeli ground invasion? Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner is the international spokesman of the IDF.
It was very impressive, the last speaker, on how distraught he is because of the situation. And of course, from our perspective, for a year now, 60,000 Israelis have been evacuated from their homes precisely because Hezbollah launched on the 8th of October its war on Israel.
Understood. And that argument is familiar. I'm asking whether in terms of the tactics now, is it a matter of when, not if, there will be a ground invasion?
Absolutely. The situation is one that over the last year, there's been extensive negotiations. And now is the time to change the paradigm. We want Israelis to go back home. Hezbollah have the choice. They can move north. They can disarm. They can go in accordance to the United Nations Security Council resolution. It's unacceptable that they have amassed a huge rocket and missile and weapons capability. They have more rockets and missiles than most European countries.
Yeah, and they're also, I mean, they are undoubtedly vastly better resourced, more battle-hardened, more dug in than Hamas in Gaza. And you haven't achieved your comprehensive victory against Hamas that was supposedly the aim after a year of utterly ruinous war for the people of Gaza. I mean, I just wonder whether, you know, that is part of the calculations here.
I think the calculation, Tim, is that we can't surrender to a terrorist organization that has, you know, they have absolutely no business launching on the 8th of October last year rockets towards Israel and engaging Israel. You know, back then, in the first month of the war, they launched 7 attempts to infiltrate Israel, just like on the 7th of October. Most of them were actually foiled before they were able to do any damage. We can't accept that reality on our northern border, and that's precisely why 60,000 Israelis were evacuated. But to get back to your first question, and absolutely weighing on the words of Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, the IDF Chief of Staff, yes, he spoke today to the forces. He told them, we are preparing for the need, if instructed, to mobilize on the ground. You know, hope is not a method from a military perspective. We need to be prepared to take necessary steps to move forward.
Yeah,
I mean, a question of if or when, I think, you know, what we've been seeing over the last few days, and I expect that we will see in the next few days, we will continue to escalate, degrade and destroy Hezbollah's capabilities, make sure that they don't have the strategic capabilities that they had accumulated over so many years.
And there is an off-ramp here, which is not military. It's called a ceasefire in Gaza. But the Prime Minister, your Prime Minister, a lot of people, including inside Israel, are saying he doesn't want that. And the IDF is being forced to do his bidding. That is why you will be forced to go into southern Lebanon.
Tim, I think there's a deep, deep consensus in Israel that 60,000 people in Israel need to be able to get home. We also want the war in Gaza to be over. We need to bring home 101 hostages. The IDF is continuing its operations in Gaza to try and achieve that. But of course, in the reality that we faced on both North and Southern fronts with terrorist organizations that are deeply, deeply embedded, it is a huge challenge. Okay. Of course, the road of diplomacy for the last year has been the chosen route for the North. But unfortunately, it hasn't delivered. And what do you expect, that 60,000 people continue to live out of home? Why should that happen? Why should that be an acceptable reality? Because Colonel, it's Israel, that's unacceptable.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner from the IDF. Well, let's get the thoughts now of one of our most experienced Middle East watchers, the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who's in Jerusalem. What does he make of the statement from the chief of the Israeli armed forces telling soldiers to prepare to go into southern Lebanon?
Well, I think he was pointing very clearly to his troops and by extension to the rest of us, because the army press office released his video and his statement saying that this is the plan, that they're going to go in. He used some interesting language. He said your maneuvering boots will be going in there and they will understand what it's like to be up against a fully trained professional army. So what he didn't say is when this might happen. So those people who are pushing right now for some at the UN, where, you know, because it's the General Assembly, high-level week, a lot of leaders are there, they're all under the same roof, they could meet, they could talk, and hope to try and find at least a delay or a truce or something like that. Perhaps the idea, because, you know, armies like the benefit of surprise, perhaps they have been... They've said that this is going to be their plan because they want to, I don't know, try and wrest some last-minute concessions out of Hezbollah. I don't think they're going to do that because, essentially, all this is about stopping Hezbollah's fire into Israel, and the Israelis are saying that by escalating, they will cause them so much pain that they'll stop doing that. But actually, today, they sent missiles in the direction of Tel Aviv, which were knocked out of the sky by Israeli interceptors. But still, it's the furthest south that they've tried to hit since all this started almost a year ago.
It does feel as if the rhetoric is certainly intensifying. At the same time, and you know this better than anyone, I mean, A, it is risky for Israel to go into southern Lebanon, and B, I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, I mean, lots of people have very strong opinions about him, but... I mean, he doesn't seem particularly to be a risk taker. So, I mean, do you think there is a chance that perhaps this could be bluff?
Well, they have done these extremely intense airstrikes in the last days. They did that attack via pagers, which caused devastating consequences, not least for civilians as well as their targets. In Hezbollah, Netanyahu, actually, while I've been talking to you, has released a brief statement saying, I can't detail everything we're doing. I can tell you we are determined to return the residents to the north home safely. We are inflicting blows on Hezbollah. What isn't clear to me is why they have chosen this moment to do it. Is it because, having failed finally to defeat 100% in the way that they promised Hamas in Gaza, they feel that they can try and move on the northern front? But, you know, Hezbollah are way better armed and much more capable militarily, not least in ground fighting, than Hamas ever were.
The BBC's international editor Jeremy Bowen speaking to me from Jerusalem. We'll have more reflections on this later here on NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, Cuba once prided itself on exceptionally low rates of crime, but has that now become a thing of the past?
So many young people have been killed this year. The violence is getting out of hand. They are basically gangs. They fall out with each other as gangs. And that's where it's all coming from, the killings and the deaths of young people.
That report from Havana in about 20 minutes. Our headlines this hour as Israel continues its bombardment of Lebanon. Its top general has told troops to be ready to go in to fight Hezbollah on the ground. The conflict has triggered concern among world leaders meeting at the United Nations in New York with the French President Emmanuel Macron, the latest to warn against all-out war. This is the BBC World Service, and live from London, you're listening to NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. The European Union, the group of 27 member states, is much, much more than the world's biggest trading bloc. It also sets rules across all sorts of areas, including, today, the status of wolves. They're being officially downgraded from strictly protected to just protected. In other words, making it easier to hunt them. The European Commission says it's necessary because the number of wolves is growing, and along with that, the danger to livestock and possibly even humans. Anouk Puymartin is head of policy at the Nature Conservation Group, BirdLife Europe and Central Asia. What does she make of the plan?
So we very much oppose to this proposal from the Commission. This proposal is actually contradicting scientific recommendation. It's contradicting facts. It's going against EU law, the EU Habitat Directive, the Berne Convention, and the wolf recovery from near extinction is one of the EU significant conservation successes. And this proposal endorses also a politically motivated decision that will, we are afraid, erode trust in governance. This proposal is actually panders to populist fears, further polarizing public debates and using the wolf as a scapegoat.
You've set out lots of arguments while you're against. I mean, the European Commission itself says, look, I mean, the point is that wolves have actually grown in such number that they are presenting a bit too much of a threat to wildlife. I mean, I think it's, you know, tens of thousands of livestock are killed in the European Union annually by wolves. We're not talking about wiping out wolves, they're saying. We're just talking about allowing the numbers to be controlled a little bit.
Yes, but the point is wolves who were nearly extinct, actually due to hunting and habitat loss, and have came back in Europe thanks to conservation work, they remain vulnerable. So 6 of 9 transboundary wolf population in the EU are actually still classified as vulnerable. So it's actually not at a level that justifies changing their status protection at the EU level.
But just on that, Anouk, I thought that individual member states were still going to be required to ensure that the wolf remains in a good conservation state. So if that is the case, if they are more vulnerable in one state, then, you know, governments will have to take responsibility for that.
Yeah, the problem is member states are already using derogation and are already abusing actually of their possibility to tackle with predation and hunting wolf in Europe. And the risk is changing. There is no scientific reason to actually change the level at the EU level, and there are already means existing to allow derogation system, which is already used by member states. So there is no reason to change the status level at this stage. And there are already many measures of coexistence that should actually be promoted instead of just destroying decades of work, actually, including not only NGOs like us, but also farmers who have been investing actually in solutions that are proving useful and avoiding livestock depredation, mitigating and avoiding impacts and disrupting livestock activity. So there are solutions existing, and what we regret is that instead of promoting these solutions, instead of using the mechanisms that are already in place, we think that this decision is not proportionate and goes to a level that is not justified except by what we consider politically, personally charged decision.
That was Anouk Puymartin, head of policy at the Nature Conservation Group, BirdLife Europe and Central Asia, making the case for wolves to remain strictly protected.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Children's eyesight appears to be getting worse. That is according to a new study published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology, which also shows that one in three children worldwide are now short-sighted or unable to see things in the distance clearly. And that number is likely to continue to rise. The highest rates are in Asia, 85% of children in Japan. Paraguay and Uganda, in contrast, had some of the lowest levels of myopia, with the UK, Ireland and the United States all at about 15%. Denise Foon is clinical advisor to the College of Optometrists in London and has been talking about the study to NewsHour's James Menendez.
The study is alarming but not surprising. I think anecdotally, our members and our optometrists have been noticing that there has been a shift and a trend towards more children becoming short-sighted.
And what do they put that down to in their anecdotal evidence, first of all?
We're never really 100% sure what causes somebody to become myopic or not. We know that it is likely that people, or more likely for people with East Asian origins, to develop myopia. But also we know that spending time outside can certainly reduce the rate of developing myopia. So what we think is perhaps likely to have happened, certainly we've seen it during COVID, is when children have been spending more time indoors and at home when they've been confined to the indoors, children seem to have developed short-sightedness at an earlier age.
It sounds like your dog wants to spend more time outside. There is a huge difference geographically, isn't it? That the numbers, as you say, in East Asia compared to those in, for example, I think Uganda in Africa. I mean, it's quite marked, isn't it?
Absolutely. And again, this could be due to genetics. So it could be because those in Japan and South Korea, that their ethnicity lends them towards developing myopia. But also it is likely that those in those countries, they're spending more time indoors, more time in their flats rather than outside.
Why does being outside help? I mean, is it simply that the children are then looking at things further in the distance and that helps the eye muscles? Is it that?
So we don't know 100% for sure, but we think that could be one of the factors, along with spending time in natural daylight. That could be another factor, or just doing more exercise when they're being outdoors.
And are there more dangers to children? I mean, obviously, you know, some people might say, well, look, it's fine. We can give children glasses and correct that. But it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, short-sightedness, so rarely, but it can happen. If you're very short-sighted, you can be more at risk of certain conditions such as retinal detachment, which is potentially sight-threatening. I mean, as I said, it is very rare, but there is a risk that the more people who are myopic, then the chances are that more people might be prone to these sorts of conditions.
Denise Voon, clinical advisor to the College of Optometrists, talking to NewsHour's James Menendez, and so it seems was Denise's dog. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. And back to our top story now. The signals that Israel may be about to step up even further the intensity of its offensive against Hezbollah. The chief of the Israel Defense Forces telling his soldiers to prepare to go into southern Lebanon. At the United Nations today, world leader after world leader called for restraint, for de-escalation. The momentum seems all the other way. One question we wanted to ask was, how this might impact the forthcoming election in the United States. Michigan is seen as a swing state, and the polling suggests that Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are pretty much tied for support. Michigan also has the highest proportion of Arab American voters. James Zogby is co-founder of the Washington-based Arab American Institute. Does he think the latest events in Lebanon could influence that vote in Michigan?
Well, we already know that the crisis in Gaza is impacting the vote. We've just completed a poll. Democratic numbers are down. Republican numbers, interestingly, are up. And voter enthusiasm among Arab Americans is lower than it has been in previous elections. So there is an impact. Because the largest percentage of the Arab American community is Lebanese, and in Michigan, a significant number of them hail from South Lebanon, whose families are directly being impacted. Actually, two of the villages from South Lebanon emptied out when Israel occupied Lebanon in the 70s and made their lives miserable. They have been in Michigan, and they are impacted by Gaza, but they're incensed by what's happening in Lebanon right now.
So explain to me, I suppose it's, you know, one can understand that voter engagement may be down and that support for the Democrats might be softening, but you also said that support for the Republicans is rising, and that does seem a bit counterintuitive given how strongly pro-Israel and pro this particular Israeli government Donald Trump has been.
Look, I've been a lifelong Democrat. I've been a member of the National Committee for 31 years and want to keep Donald Trump away from the White House. But there is an element of revenge, if you will, of punishing Democrats at work here. Where you have more recent immigrants, there's not a strong party ID. Party identification in America is low anyway. It's quite fluid in many times, unlike in other countries where you join a party, you become a member, you go to meetings. That's not the case. It's a kind of a fluid situation of how you feel. Right now, people in particular, younger voters and recent immigrants, simply don't feel any party identification with Democrats. They feel let down, betrayed, hurt, angry, and the rest. And so they're not going to pull a Democratic lever. Why do they pull a Republican lever? Part of it is a sort of a rejection in your face. We're punishing you for what you've done. And understand, these are immigrants who are doing fairly well. They're in business. You know, they've done well here in America. And so it's not as if there's a sense that they'll suffer. I am opposed to what they're doing. I think, you know, allies that we have on the Middle East need a Democratic president, black voters, Latino voters, immigrants across the board. But right now there's an anger. And many of the other constituencies that I've mentioned just then, they're understanding why Arab Americans are upset.
And do you think it could get to the point where actually it could be the decisive factor in a place like Michigan?
Polls that show Harris up 3 or 4%, you have to figure on a national level, that means you take 6 to 7 million votes surplus in California, New York, and Illinois. That means that pretty much the rest of the country is going to be very close. And that's an issue. You've got a lot of swing states, more swing states in this election than you've had previously. So yes, when you're talking about a community of 100,000 votes here or 200,000 votes there, it can have a real impact. And I think that attention isn't being paid enough by Democrats to that impact. Frankly, polling we've seen shows that what people are asking for at a minimum would not negatively impact the candidate at all, but would positively impact if they had done it. If they'd had a Palestinian American speaking at the Democratic convention, not 5 Jewish votes would have been lost, but a lot of Arab American votes might have been won. Okay. And I think that they're making a mistake by ignoring that.
And that was James Zogby, co-founder of the Washington-based Arab American Institute, looking at how far events in the Middle East could influence the vote in Michigan. And Michigan, indeed, is where Donald Trump's pick for the vice presidential nomination, J.D. Vance, I was giving a very English makeover there. J.D. Vance will speak in a few hours. Now, one other thing to let you know about if you're interested in the US election. NewsHour's been travelling to the US swing states. You may have heard some of our reporting. We have a special bonus NewsHour podcast episode. It's coming out tomorrow. There's some stuff from Georgia, where I was, focusing on the people who haven't yet decided how they will vote. We'll hear from the survivalists in Oregon, and James Menendez has been finding out how young voters in Missouri are feeling now that the Midwest is in the spotlight.
But I'm very excited to be a part of Swing State, and I feel like I have an important role in trying to get all of my friends and extended family members to vote and be a part of the democratic process.
Would you go along with what you've been hearing? I mean, is it nice to feel like the Midwest is the center of attention? I mean, which it is.
Yeah, it is really nice. And I think something special about the Midwest is we have a lot of swing states, and so our votes matter a decent amount. Obviously, in Ohio, that's become less true as we've gotten more red. But I think it's definitely important for people to feel empowered in a region where they normally don't feel as empowered because the attention isn't really on the Midwest as much. So I think it's a good change of pace when an election comes up and people feel like their voices are heard.
Some voices from Missouri, and you can hear more about what we discovered on some of these journeys through US swing states. That's the NewsHour podcast bonus episode. Just search for BBC NewsHour wherever you get your BBC podcasts. You'll find it there. Fidel Castro famously called Cuba the safest country in the world, and at least when it came to the island's traditionally low rates of violent crime, he may have been onto something. But more recently, the situation appears to be worsening in the country. Official government crime statistics remain low, but many Cubans believe that those fail to reflect the reality on the streets. More and more victims have reported their experiences on social media, from muggings at knife point to burglary and even gang-related violence. And adding to the problem is the popularity of a cheap new drug in Cuba, as Will Grant reports from Havana.
In the low-income Havana neighbourhood of Cayo Hueso, friends of an aspiring music producer called Ian Franco gathered to send him off in song. Just 19 years old when he was killed, Ian was stabbed twice in the chest following a disagreement outside a recording studio, caught in the middle when one of the youths pulled a knife. Another tragic killing on the traditionally safe Caribbean island. A month on, his older sister Samantha remains in a state of numb grief. As she scrolls through photos of Ian Franco on her computer, she says her brother's murder has torn a hole in her family. Yet Ian Franco is just one of many to have been killed in recent months over trivial arguments and gang rivalries, says Samantha.
So many young people have been killed this year. The violence is getting out of hand. They are basically gangs. They fall out with each other as gangs. And that's where it's all coming from, the killings and the deaths of young people.
Do these gangs often solve their quarrels with knives and machetes, I asked her.
Yes, almost no one settles an argument with their fists anymore. It's all knives, machetes, even guns. Things I just don't understand.
Samantha adds that a new drug called Químico, a cheap chemical high with a cannabis base, is increasingly popular among Cuban youth in the parks and on the streets. Previously, just saying that Cuba has a problem with street drugs and violent crime, especially to a foreign journalist, could land you in trouble. The authorities in Havana have always played down the social problems on the island and been quick to paint any criticism of their communist system as anti-revolutionary lies, originating from Miami or Washington. But such has been the perception of a sharp drop in public security that top government officials had to acknowledge the problem on state TV, including a discussion of the drug Químico. On air, the government claimed just 9% of crimes in Cuba are violent and just 3% are murders. However, there is a serious lack of transparency over government crime statistics. In large part, the Cuban state continues to blame the old enemy, the United States, for both the presence of opioids on the island and for the U.S. embargo, which they argue has made economic life in Cuba so dire that some are turning to crime.
And so the difficulty facing the authorities in Cuba is that a low crime rate has traditionally been one of the revolution's standout achievements. When critics pointed to the lack of rights on the island, they would retort that the streets of Havana were safer than almost any in the United States. So if that's now beginning to slip, people will increasingly ask what exactly they're getting in return for their lack of basic freedoms.
en esa escala de delitos penales es menor.
In a rare interview, the vice president of Cuba's Supreme Court, Marisela Sosa, insisted to the BBC that only a tiny fraction of crimes committed involved violence and were being blown out of proportion on social media. And she refuted the suggestion that many crimes go unreported through a lack of confidence in the police.
In my 30 years as a judge and magistrate, I don't think that the Cuban people lack confidence in their authorities, because in Cuba, the police have a high success rate in solving crimes. Problems are resolved, and we don't see people taking the law into their own hands, which happens in other parts of Latin America and elsewhere, which suggests people trust in the Cuban justice system.
Most people in Cuba, it seems, have either recently been a victim of opportunistic theft themselves or have a friend, neighbour or relative who has been. Many remain wary of talking publicly, but Shaida Gonzalez, a transgender activist in Cuba, is used to speaking out and says her story of being robbed at knife point of all her personal effects one night on Havana's dark streets is now common. It was the response by the police which disillusioned her the most, she adds.
After the attack, I came across two motorbike police officers in a nearby street. I was very distressed and said to them, "Look what just happened to me." But they directly told me, "We're not here for stuff like that." It was such an awful thing to hear because I told them where they could find the attacker, showed them which direction he was headed in, what he was wearing, but they just didn't pay any attention to me.
In contrast to their raucous singing, when the moment came to load Jan Franco onto the hearse, his friends shouldered his coffin in hushed tones and tearful murmurings. Cuba's youth face more difficulties growing up than most in the Caribbean, and many have fled in search of greater opportunities. Those that stay must now contend with rising crime too, as another pillar of the Cuban Revolution, public safety, now looks more unstable than at any other time since the Cold War.
And that was Will Grant reporting from Havana. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. One final voice to bring you today on the strong signals that Israel is sending out that it's preparing for a ground invasion of southern Lebanon in an effort, it says, to stop Hezbollah firing rockets into northern Israel. If it does come to an Israeli ground incursion, as the chief of the IDF has now strongly hinted, here's someone who knows what that might mean, at least from the Israeli side. Asael Lubotsky is a doctor, a molecular biologist, an author, and a combat veteran from the Second Lebanon War, as it was called, the 34-day war of 2006.
So I served as a young officer in the IDF, and during the Second Lebanese War in 2006, and while fighting in southern Lebanon, during a battle, I was hit by an advanced anti-tank missile. The missile hit my armored vehicle, which I was commanding. Two of my men were injured, and I was severely injured. I was in critical condition. And my friends managed to evacuate me out of their burning vehicle. And they put me on a stretcher, ran downhill from this area. During the evacuation, I thought I'm losing my leg. I saw my leg almost falling apart from the stretcher. And they managed to evacuate me from this battlefield where my men were fighting to the border, where a helicopter took me out of this area, directly to the hospital. I was in a severe condition, requiring 9 blood units, and I spent a few days in the ICU. And then for over a year, I went through a rehabilitation process, going through 15 surgeries and many medical treatments, until I was able to walk again with crutches. But that was my journey to come back to life.
Asael, I mean, it's a story of you sustaining very serious injury. And I wonder what it makes you think tonight. I mean, as we hear the words of Herzi Halevi, the chief of the Israel Defense Forces, saying to troops, prepare to go over the border once again, prepare to fight Hezbollah on their territory. What does that make you think?
So I will tell you that the memories are difficult. I mean, losing friends and sustaining my own injuries, I think that I will never forget. As I told you, I was severely injured, and I have memories that will stay with me for life, both physically and emotionally. I have those thoughts. But at the same time, I do know that the reason that the IDF now prepares an invasion is not because we or anyone in Israel seek war. To the contrary, I think people are trying to avoid war as they can. But I think it comes from empathy. It comes from people in our country that think about the northern residents who have like a threat any day that could be they have a fear of rockets raining down or Radwan terrorists invading homes. So the reason is not because anyone seeks war, but we want to avoid war, but we also want to avoid casualties on our end. So it is like a hard memories, but I think I feel from my friends who also are called even tonight to the northern border that people do it not because they want to do it, because there's no other chance. And I hope there's going to be a way to avoid it.
I guess, I mean, there are two questions that arise out of that. One is, you know, whether it is the right thing to do, whether it is the only response. But the other question, which I want to come to first, though, is just, you know, there are some voices, maybe they're in a minority in Israel, but who advocate strongly that Israel should have as much security as possible. And yes, people in the north of the country should be able to return home. But Israel's experience of fighting in southern Lebanon is a very hard one. And Hezbollah is a very well-armed, battle-hardened, dug-in force. And that it is a massive risk, perhaps too great a risk, for Israel to go in. Indeed, some are saying it's a trap that Hassan Nasrallah, the chief of Hezbollah, is laying for Israel.
So I would say that the 2006 war taught me firsthand how complex war is, and specifically how complex modern warfare can be, especially when you fight in densely populated areas and where people can hide among civilians and store rockets among civilians. I mean, you know how complex it is. I'm not an expert in the military process today. What is the right choice from a military perspective? I leave this to the generals, chief of staff, Halevi. I do know that when people consider war, both in the army and in the general population, people know how complex and scary it is. And there are so many wounded soldiers and so many people who were injured and killed by terror attacks in the past year and in general in Israel. So we know that the war is one of the worst case scenarios. So I really believe that although we strive for peace, when war comes, it's only as a necessity, not because anyone strives for a war. If it's a trap or not, it's hard to say. Mm. I hope that the IDF, as our military, as our army, knows the way how to challenge Hezbollah and try to push them back in order to avoid events like October 7 happening in the north. This is the biggest fear of people in Israel.
I mean, the other argument, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is that at best, even if somehow this were to work, somehow a decisive victory were scored over Hezbollah, it only buys a bit of time, and it will sow such devastation on the people of Lebanon. Inevitably, there will be a large number of people who are not connected with Hezbollah who are hurt or killed, and it just further poisons the soil. That's one of the arguments that is often made about these types of operations.
Yeah, it is a major argument, and I think it is important to point out that the fight, or our fight, is not against Lebanese people. It's against
terrorist inevitably, I mean, they will end up suffering.
Yeah, and war inevitably has people suffer from both sides when there is war. But I also understand how is it to grow up with a fear on a daily basis that a rocket will come or a terrorist will enter your house. So you have to manage and balance those threats. Is there like a great solution? Probably not. We have to take the right choices, but we are choosing between like maybe bad and worse. There's no like a very a good solution for these conflicts, unfortunately.
Asael Lubotsky, now a doctor, then back in 2006, a combat veteran from the Second Lebanon War. From all of us on NewsHour, thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.